بسم الله الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله. So fasting in Ramadan. So what is fasting? Ramadan is really mainly about fasting. That's one of the most important things that we do. So let's cover the details of fasting. Fasting is really an exercise in self-control, and it's designed to bring a Muslim closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So the goal of fasting is to get you closer to Allah. And what fasting really involves is three main things. It involves refraining from food, refraining from drink, and refraining from intercourse throughout the day, throughout the daytime. And I'm going to explain all of that in more detail. So Muslims are required to fast in the month of Ramadan. It's a requirement. It's not something optional. It's not something that you do if you choose. If you feel like it today, then you go ahead and you do it. If it's convenient for you, you go ahead and you do it. It's something that we're required to do as Muslims every Ramadan. And the reason why it's the Ramadan is the month, is a month in the Islamic lunar calendar. There are 12 months in the Islamic lunar calendar, and the ninth month is the month of Ramadan. So we use January, February, March, April, May, and in the Islamic calendar, the lunar calendar, there's different names for the months: Sha'ban, Ramadan, you know, Shawwal, all of these different months, Dhul Hijjah, Muharram. So Ramadan is the ninth month in that calendar, okay? And that's what we're using when we say the month of Ramadan. So why Ramadan? Who knows, why do we fast Ramadan? Why not in the month of Dhul Hijjah? Why not in the month of Muharram? It's the first month. Exactly. That's when the Quran was revealed to the Prophet, peace be upon him. And he was, that's according to some narrations, yeah. So mainly, the main reason is because the Quran was revealed in the month. So what are we actually doing when we celebrate and we fast in the month of Ramadan? We're actually celebrating the Quran. We're honoring the Quran. That's why the Ramadan is called the month of the Quran, because it was revealed, and because we're actually giving special emphasis to this month because the Quran was revealed. Now, there are other fasts that Muslims do throughout the year outside of Ramadan as well. Some of them are recommended, some of them are highly recommended, but Ramadan are the ones which are required, and they're the only ones which are absolutely required throughout the year. So keep in mind that when we talk about fasting, fasting is an act of worship, very much like prayer, very much like giving your zakah. It's a direct act of worship, and you can perform fasting like prayer almost any time throughout the year. So you can fast, like you can pray almost any time throughout the day, with very few exceptions, right? So those who are actually enrolled in our official class, what are some of the exceptions for prayer when you are not allowed to pray? After Fajr. After you pray your Fajr, during sunrise, and during sunset, right? So these are the main times, and after you pray your Asr. So the same thing with fasting. You can fast almost any time you want throughout the year, with few exceptions, and it works the same way. So fasting is a great act of worship, and in fact, fasting is not only an optional act of worship, which you can just do, it's also a penalty, what's called a kafara, which is a makeup penalty for certain acts which you've missed. So for example, if you make a vow and you swear, say, I swear by Allah, I'm going to do such and such thing, and then you break your vow and you don't do it, you have to do what's called kafar. You learn this in Islamic law too if you take the class. You have to do what's called kafar, meaning you have to pay a penalty or make up for that broken vow of yours. And one of the ways to make it up is by fasting. All right, is by fasting. Does anyone know how many days the fasting is? 3 days. So it's 3 days actually. So that's one option for making up a broken vow. But you'll learn that in a different class if you take our Islamic Law 2 class. So fasting has a number of functions. Number one, it's mandatory in the month of Ramadan. Number two, it's recommended throughout the year. It's recommended, you know, to do it anytime you want. It's highly recommended on certain days of the year, which we'll talk about. And number four, that's number three, and number four, it's a makeup or an expiation for certain things which you've done wrong, which are specifically mentioned in the Quran. So who needs to fast? This is really the main section we should start with. Who needs to fast? Okay, who's required to fast and who's not required to fast? Meaning, when can you skip out and when can you not skip out? So number one, you got to be a Muslim to fast. So you don't force your non-Muslim friends or something like that. Come on, you gotta fast. You can encourage them and they can try it. And in fact, many non-Muslims at college campuses around the country when they tried to fast, they experienced something that they've never experienced in their life. All right, anyone fasted before they accepted Islam? Regina, you tried it as well, right? So there's a lot of people, and they felt like, wow, this is really something, you know? So it's a really good tool for, you know, explaining what Islam is for people, to let them experience it, what it's going to be like to actually fast. But you don't, of course, you know, force it upon them or try to convince them, you got to do it, it's Ramadan, okay? It's not Ramadan for them. So just keep that in mind. So first of all, you got to be a Muslim. Number two, you have to be mature. So these are the conditions of fasting. What makes it mandatory? Number two is maturity, having maturity. And maturity is something that we talked about in this class. By the way, for those of you who are visiting, this is actually a 10-week class, but we just opened this portion up to the rest of the community. But this is actually the 10th week of a 10-week class. So we covered that. What is maturity? Maturity is the same as the maturity for prayer. So you have to be at the age of maturity, or the age of Islamic puberty, when you reach the age when you need to start praying. So does anyone remember what that age, or how you determine that someone is mature is? Does anyone remember that? So basically it's three things. It's not intellectual, because you can't tell that. But basically what it is when a guy or a girl, a boy or a girl, has their first wet dream or equivalent, when a girl has her first menstruation, and if none of those happen until the age of 15, they're automatically considered to be mature. As long as there's no signs of intellectual, you know, barriers in their way. So this is the maturity. So when a person reaches the age of maturity, they need to start praying. They're obligated to start praying, and they're also obligated to start fasting. So the age of prayer and the age of fasting is the same. It's not like it's different. So once you need to start praying, you need to start fasting, and vice versa. Okay, so that's the way it is. But keep in mind, children who've not reached the age of maturity yet, even though they're not obligated, just like prayer, they're supposed to be taught to start fasting. So we said that children should be taught to start praying at what age? This is according to the Prophet, peace be upon him. At the age of 7. They should be taught at the age of 7 to start doing this. Sometimes. Meaning to understand what it is, not fasting all 30 days. Not praying all 5 prayers, but getting in the habit, look, this is how you do it. Try one here, try one there. Here's a little reward for you. Here's, you know, we'll take you to, you know, the park or something like that. Whatever it is. By the age of 10, as a parent, your responsibility is to make them fast and to make them pray. You have to ensure that they're praying, and you have to ensure that they're fasting by the age of 10. But in terms of when are they going to be held accountable in front of Allah, that's when they reach the age of maturity. Okay, so your job as a parent is different than the way that Allah is going to be judging them. So this is something that to keep in consideration. And in fact, the companions, you know, they used to get their children, even the young children, they used to teach them how to fast. And one of the companions, one of the women, she was explaining how she gets her child to fast. And she says she used to make this little little doll out of like wool. It's like a little toy or something like that. And she says, you know, I would pull out that toy the last few hours before fast is about to break, because that's when the children get really, really hungry. The day's gone for a very long time, and I would distract them with like a little drama, you know, kind of play around with them, and then they would get distracted, and they would be done with the fast for that day. So it's really important that we teach our children as well to start fasting. Sometimes we neglect it. So, oh, they'll fast when they get older. At least teach them, because if they stay that way for a very, very long time, they're not going to fast when they get older, because they were never taught in the first place. And they became accustomed to not fasting, and it's going to be detrimental to their future. So as parents, you have a responsibility to make sure that your children learn how to pray, and make sure that they do pray. And likewise, that they learn how to fast, and that they do fast. You start it, and you have 3 years to prep them. From the age of 7, 8, and 9. 3 years, once they hit 10, now they're fasting. Everyone in the family knows this child is going to be fasting now in your family, inshallah. All right, so that's maturity. Number three is sanity. So a person has to be sane. They should be free of any mental illness or anything like that. Otherwise, they're treated like children, in the sense that they're not going to be held accountable in front of Allah for not having fasted. But of course, they should also be taught to do so, and they should be encouraged to do so. Number four, freedom from illness. So meaning a person who is ill is not required to fast. So what you do is you check and you say, okay, if I'm sick, that means I don't have to fast. So why and how do I qualify as being a person who's ill? So anyone who's suffering from an illness, where fasting is probably either going to, number one, cause harm to your body, number two, increase your illness that you already have, or number three, delay your recovery, then they're excused from fasting. These three things. So we're not talking about, you know what, I coughed a little bit in the morning, if I'm sick, I'm not going to fast. Right? Or if you have a little bit of a temperature and the fast is only like, let's say, 8 hours and it happens to be in the winter, you could probably keep that fast. You're going to be perfectly fine for the day. You take a Tylenol in the morning and you'll be okay for the rest of, you know, acetaminophen. Okay? I don't want to advertise for giant corporations. So you take acetaminophen in the morning and you're going to be fine. All right. So in this case, right, you don't have to skip out on fasting. But if you're ill and it's actually going to affect your body, it's going to really mess you up. You got the flu, right? You got, you know, mucus coming out and you've got a really high temperature and everything. It's going to mess you up if you end up fasting that day. So you're excused from fasting and you don't need to fast. So how do you determine what level of severity should be there in terms of whether you should fast or you should not fast? Because some people, look, people are different. Some people are like really hardcore. So they got the flu, 104 degree temperature. I'm doing it, man. I'm gonna fast anyways. And then there are other people, they have like a paper cut. They're like, so can I skip fasting? Because it's very painful, you know? The thing is, you have to be in the balance. You have to be in the middle. So the best way is to consult an expert or consult with someone who has knowledge about that condition, whether this is really gonna harm you and in what way is it gonna harm you. So you go and you ask and you say, how is this going to harm me if I fast and I avoid eating and drinking for the whole day? To what level is this really going to affect my body in terms of short-term, you know, effect and long-term effect? And you ask that, you find out, and then you determine, should I be fasting or should I not be fasting? If you're in doubt and you've consulted with someone who has knowledge, then you go and you consult someone who has Islamic knowledge. So you first consult someone who has medical knowledge and you figure out what the effect is going to be. And then if you're not sure, is this an effect which is enough of an illness or it's too little of an illness or too little of a difficulty, then you consult someone with Islamic knowledge and say, this is what the expert medical practitioner said, this is what's likely to happen, now should I fast or should I not fast? And then we can help give you the answer on that one. Alright, so someone who's ill and it's really going to affect them, they don't need to fast. Another group of people who falls into the same category are pregnant women and breastfeeding women. And that's only if the pregnancy or the fasting is going to either harm them or it's going to harm their child. The breastfeeding is going to harm them or it's going to harm their child. It doesn't matter. If it harms anyone, then they could be excused from that fasting. Okay? But keep in mind, when we say someone who has an illness, we're talking about someone who has the flu. How long does the flu generally last? 5-7 days. Have you ever heard of the flu like lasting an entire year on average? Yeah, a month, but not a whole year, right? So this is considered an incidental illness, meaning it's not a chronic long-term illness. It's acute. It's going to go away after a period of time. So whenever you have an illness like this, you don't fast on that day, but you have to make it up once you're feeling better. So once the illness is gone, once the pregnancy is over, once the breastfeeding period has ended, you have to make that period up. Okay? There's another category, which is chronic inability. Okay? So the next category is someone who has a chronic issue. Chronic means continuing for a very long period of time. Okay? It's going to be persistent. So someone who has a chronic inability. So for example, someone who has a chronic illness, they have diabetes. Someone has some type of other illness which just happens on a regular basis. That person is in a different category. They don't need to fast, but they don't have to make up their fast afterwards either because they're always going to remain in that state of illness. So if it's going to keep on persisting for a long time, they don't need to fast. Someone who's very old, they become very weak, it's very difficult to fast. Let's say you're in your 80s, you know, hitting 90s or something like that. It's going to be very difficult for those people. So they don't have to fast either. And the other person who falls in this category are women who have a pregnancy and then breastfeeding, and then pregnancy again, and then breastfeeding again back to back, such that it lasts for an entire year. So from one Ramadan to the next Ramadan, they missed one Ramadan because they had either pregnancy or breastfeeding. And then they had no opportunity to make up those missed fasts because they either were another pregnancy or breastfeeding until the next Ramadan. So if that lasts for an entire year, then they're considered to be in the chronic category, which means that they don't need to make up those fasts. Even though you're not gonna, you know, you're not gonna keep getting pregnant and keep breastfeeding for like 30, 40 years in a row. So, but technically you consider it to be chronic because it's more than a year. So any type of thing that's more than a year from one Ramadan to the next Ramadan is considered in the chronic category. So you don't have to make up those fasts. But instead, because imagine if you had to. If someone has pregnancy, then breastfeeding, and then pregnancy, and then breastfeeding, that could last, let's say, 3 years. Now when you're done, you decide, you know what, let's take a break from having some kids for now. Then you got to make up 3 years of fasting. That's a lot, right? To be done in 1 year. So instead, they fall in the chronic category where they don't have to make it up, but they do the expiation, which is feeding a poor person for every single day of fasting that they missed. So anyone who falls into this category has to feed a poor person for every day that they missed. So this is the way it's different. So if you're sick and you have the flu, you're going to skip your fasting, and you're going to make up the fasting after Ramadan is over, sometime before the next Ramadan comes in, anytime, and you're okay. If you have a chronic condition like diabetes, because it's chronic, or you're very, very old and you can't fast anymore, every single day you miss, you're not going to make it up, and you're just going to feed a poor person. You're going to use your money to or get some food, and you're going to go and feed a poor person for every day. And that way, you actually participate and get the reward like fasting without having to fast because you weren't able to, but you're feeding someone else. Okay, so you're fulfilling a very similar purpose when it comes to fasting. So that's another category. The next category is someone who's not traveling is required to fast. So that means that if you're traveling and you're on a journey, you're not required to fast due to some of the difficulties involved with traveling, some of the inconveniences involved. So we talked about prayers. So when you're traveling and you're praying, the prayers are different, right? The prayers are shortened when you're traveling as well. So we had talked about that before. So now we notice that even in even when it comes to fasting, there's some changes in the rules in terms of fasting. You don't have to fast when you're traveling. But keep one thing in mind. It doesn't mean you're prevented from fasting. It doesn't mean you're not allowed to fast. It means you don't have to. So there's a difference. So if you're traveling, let's say, to San Francisco, and it's a very easy trip, and you're just jumping on an airplane, and you just fly an hour and a half, and you're going to land there and everything, you say, you know what, this is a piece of cake. Like this traveling is not difficult for me at all. I handle it all the time. It's actually better to fast if there's almost no difficulty. If there's a lot of difficulty involved, it's better not to fast. You don't have to try to be that hardcore person where you're getting hot and you're in the sun and you're sweating and all of that. It's not the best thing to do, right? Like my brother and I, one time we were literally getting on a plane from Jeddah, Arabia, right after the fast began. And we're flying back to LA. So you're going back in time. We wanted to be really hardcore and like we're fasting. It ended up to be like a 30-hour fast, right? So we're young, we could handle it, alhamdulillah, but it's generally, you don't have to be that, you know, hardcore. If it's going to be really long or difficult, or if you're in the sun or so you're traveling through the, you know, desert or something like that, you don't have to fast. It's better not to fast. You take that. But if it's really, really easy, then just go ahead and fast anyways. So you have that concession, you don't have to fast. And we've seen this concession of traveling even when it comes to praying Jummah prayer. The same thing. If it's easy for you, you're traveling through, and the Friday prayer, there's a mosque nearby, it's better to actually go and, you know, to attend the sermon. But you're not required to the way you would be if you weren't traveling, if you're a resident. All right, so that's the next category. The next category is being free from menstruation and lochia. Right? So we mentioned that when you're menstruating, when a woman is menstruating, or when she's going through her lochia period, her postnatal period after she gives birth, then they're not required to pray, and there's some other conditions, you know, associated with that. Also, women will not be fasting during that time when they're undergoing menstruation and when they're in their period of lochia, 40 days or less after they've delivered and they're bleeding. So they're exempted from fasting. But Ramadan, so we talked about before in prayer, when a woman has this condition, either she's in her period of menstruation or her period of lochia, does she need to make up the missed prayers? She doesn't need to make up the missed prayers, right? So if a woman is not fasting because of the same reason, does she need to make up the missed fast? Yes. The answer is yes. The question is why not make up the prayers, but why you have to make up the missed fast? It's because the prayers are every single day. And if you're missing, you're going to, at the end, you're going to be missing so many prayers, you have to make up like 35 prayers right after. That would be very difficult for you. But when is the required fasting? It's only once a year. It's not an everyday thing, it's only once a year. So if you skip like, let's say, 7 days or even 10 days of fasting, you can make it up, you have an entire year to make that up, and you're only making up like 7 or 10 or maybe 15 at most, and you can actually split them up over time. It's actually even easier for you. So it's actually not very difficult at all to do that. So Islam came to make it easy for you. It's actually designed to not overburden you. So you don't have to make up those prayers that you missed due to menstruation or lochia period, but you do have to make up the fast that you missed. So it's very important that when a woman is skipping those fasts, she keeps track of them. Keep it, you know, in a database or write it down somewhere so that you don't forget. And I can't emphasize this enough because I get questions all the time. I totally forgot how many I missed. All the time. And you know, from the previous year, I also forgot how many I missed. You need to write it down. Right, so you shouldn't be forgetting this. You should remember this. It's very, very important to keep in mind because it's like a debt. You know, it's like a debt that you owe Allah. You skip this many fasts, you need to make up this many fasts. So even for the guys, they should write it down whenever they're missing a number of fasts due to illness or whatever it is. Okay, so that is the fasting. So those are the requirements. Okay, in terms of who must fast and who doesn't need to fast. The next thing is to determine the month of Ramadan. How do we figure out when the month of Ramadan is exactly? So something you have to keep in mind is that it's really, really important to figure out the beginning and the end of the month of Ramadan, because that's when you're going to be fasting. And that's, you know, how you're going to know when to start and when to stop. So Muslims use the Islamic lunar calendar, like I mentioned before. And the Islamic lunar calendar has 12 months. It's not linked with the seasons like the solar calendar that we use in America is. And the year consists of, anyone know how many days in an Islamic lunar year? 11 days short. It's 11 days short. So to be precise, 354.37 days. Okay, those are how many days are in the Islamic lunar calendar. And that's because the mean time between new moons is 29.53 days. Okay, to be precise. So basically what that means is, every single day in the Islamic lunar calendar is either going to be 29 days or 30 days. It's either a 29-day month or a 30-day month, but it's not fixed. So like January is always how many days? 31. And February, okay, forget February. March, April is how many days? It's always 30, right? But when it comes to the Islamic lunar calendar, that's not the case. So 1 year, it can be 29 days. 1 year, it can be 30 days. So it fluctuates. It could be one of these two, and it can't be anything else. And there's no leap year or anything like that. Like February has leap year. So this is because you have to make an adjustment in certain calculations. So the adjustment happens automatically in the Islamic lunar calendar rather than having a forced adjustment. So this is, you know, the lunar calendar is determined by the lunar phase that you find in the sky. So the way that the sun shines on the moon and our position on Earth relative to looking at the moon and the position of the moon relative to the Earth is going to determine what you see in the sky. You're going to either see a little tiny thin crescent, or you're going to see, you know, half crescent, or you're going to see a full moon, and it varies throughout the month. So we actually have a seminar about that tonight at 5:45. If you can make it for that seminar, I really recommend you come. But that's the way the month is generally going to be determined, based on the lunar phases. So the beginning of the month is determined when there's no moon, the moon is not visible, and then all of a sudden that little tiny faint side of the crescent begins to be shown initially. That's considered to be the beginning of the month. So what we do, that's called a new moon crescent. That's called a new crescent, the crescent of the new moon. So what you do is, the 8th month, so Ramadan is which month in the lunar calendar? The 9th month. So what you do is you look at the 8th month, and the 8th month in the lunar calendar, which is what we're in now, is called Sha'ban. So Sha'ban is the 8th month, and on the 29th day of Sha'ban, you look at the crescent, and you see, can you see the beginning of that crescent, or you can't see it? If you can see it, then that means the month of Sha'ban is over, and the month of Ramadan has begun. If you don't see it, it means that the month of Sha'ban has 30 days now, instead of 29, because you can only have 29 or 30. So what you do is, on the 29th of Sha'ban, Muslims used to go outside, they look out in the sky, and they look for the moon. If they see the moon, the little tiny part of the moon, they say, okay, it's Ramadan, the first, starting tomorrow now, because we saw the moon, and today's the 29th of Sha'ban. Sha'ban had 29 days, and now we start Ramadan the next day. If they don't see it, it means that Sha'ban is going to have 30 days, and it's going to automatically be seen tomorrow for sure, because Sha'ban cannot have 31 days. So Ramadan will be the following day, the day after. Okay, so that's the first way to determine what's happening. Now, Muslims should be trying to figure out exactly when the moon is going to be visible. And this is something which has been practiced throughout history for a very long time, that you search the sky on the 29th and you start checking. So when you start checking, what do you do with that? So what you do is, if you see the moon, or someone else sees the moon, the new moon, the crescent of it, they take these sightings and they report it to a recognized Muslim authority. So there are, in the past, there used to be an Islamic State, and there was a Khalifa in charge of that Islamic State. So they would report it to the official headquarters of the Khalifa, who's the leader of the Muslims. And then they would take those sightings and say, okay, who's the person that sighted it? In what location did they sight it? What did they claim to have seen? And they look at it and they determine, is this person reliable? Is this sighting seem to be accurate? Does it seem to be reliable in any case, shape, way, or form? And then they're going to determine whether or not they should start the month of Ramadan or not. Should they accept the testimony of these people who claim to see the moon or not? Because otherwise any random person can just say, oh, well, I'm just going to go ahead and lie and say, yeah, I saw the moon. So there's some criteria involved in accepting the testimony of a person who's claiming to sight the moon for the beginning of Ramadan. Today, if we don't have a Khalifa or a Muslim leader, we should at least go to recognized Muslim authorities like a Council of Scholars or something like that. In the absence of a Council of Scholars, we're going to have a lot of problems. Or in the absence of having a Council of Scholars, but the Muslims are not following that Council of Scholars, we're going to have a little bit disunity in this regard, especially in a locality. And that's one of the reasons why we kind of have this. There are different opinions, and there's no unanimity because there's no real recognized Council of Scholars in our area. So it's okay. It's not the end of the world. We're still going to be fasting, but you got to keep in mind that there's some room for the real reason why there's people start on different days is because of the lack of a central authority established and respected among the Muslim community. It's not due to this person doesn't know this, and this person is weird, and this person is backwards. The real reason is we don't have a centralized authority. And if we did, the problem would be solved, because everyone else would have to give up their own opinion, and they'd have to follow that authority. And that's the way it would actually have to be. So generally what would happen is you give this information to the authority, and they determine whether or not they're going to start Ramadan or not. One of the ways that they would determine it is they would check and say, look, is there an obstruction in the sky? If there was an obstruction in the sky that you weren't able to see the moon, for example, it was a cloudy day, or there's fog, or whatever, it's very cloudy or something like that, you can't really see, it's not easy for the average person to see the moon when it's very cloudy. You may not be able to see it. So in this case, they said, we will accept the testimony of one Muslim witness who has upright character. Whether they're male or female, their testimony will be accepted. If we can tell that this person is telling the truth, they know what they're doing, they know what they saw, we're going to go ahead and accept their testimony. Why? Because it's not likely that most people are going to be able to see anything because it's extremely cloudy. So they may have been in a region where that cloud wasn't above them and they were able to see it. But if the sky is clear and there's no obstruction in the sky, then one or two or three people is not going to be sufficient to validate that they saw the crescent and Ramadan is going to be started the next day. Why? Because it's very easy for everyone to figure out. Everyone should be able to see the moon if it's there when the sky is clear. So this person is claiming to see it, yet everyone else who was looking, no one else saw it. So why did this guy see it, but all these other people didn't see it? Something doesn't seem right. So the criteria is, if the sky is clear, there has to be a large, large number of people who are reporting having sighted the moon. Otherwise, their testimony is not going to be accepted. What is the exact number? That's there for them to determine, right? So there's flexibility in determining that. Now, here's a little side issue which is interesting. Probably not going to happen to you, but it's interesting. If you see the moon by yourself, you see the moon and you're sure that you saw the moon, but you go to the Muslim authority and your testimony is rejected. They say, no, we don't trust you, or we think you were hallucinating or something like that. You didn't see it, but you're sure. You have a feeling you're pretty sure. I'm pretty sure I saw it. You're supposed to fast by yourself, but not go around telling other people about what you saw if your testimony has been rejected. Why not? Because you're going to cause a fitna, or you're going to cause division and problems in the community if you start telling them, look, they rejected me and I saw it and I'm telling you and this and that. The goal is not to go and create disturbances and problems in the community. But you still, since you saw it and you have that level of certainty in yourself, you have to go ahead and fast yourself. So you have certainty for you, but not certainty for other people. All right, so that's just an interesting theoretical issue to keep in mind. Now, if the moon is sighted anywhere in a land where Muslims are present in that area to some extent, meaning there's some type of Muslim community in that area, and the month of Ramadan will begin for every single Muslim around the entire world. And this is according to the majority of scholars. Some scholars have said, no, it's every locality has their own sighting of the moon. But this means that if in Argentina, and there's a Muslim community in Argentina, if they see the moon and they let the people everywhere else in the world know that, you know what, we saw the moon, all Muslims are going to start fasting the next day. So the sighting of that moon in that community is going to count for all Muslims in the entire world. And this is the majority opinion. Okay? There's another way to aid in the sighting of the moon. So the question is, when you sight the moon, does it have to be with the naked eye? Or can you use binoculars? Or can you use a telescope? Or can you use a super telescope? Or can you use certain calculations which have actually astronomical calculations to determine the crescent visibility in a certain region or not, right? So this has been the issue of somewhat of a debate in the last century in particular. Actually, it's been throughout history, but even more it's picked up in the last century. So there's a few things. One of them is to use astronomical data. You're allowed to use astronomical data, according to one opinion, in order to reject somebody's sighting, but not to confirm somebody's sighting. So if somebody comes and says, you know what, I saw the moon, you know, and then three guys come and they say, we all saw it, right in this location and everything. And you say, look, according to the calculations which we have, in that region, at that time, you said you saw it at 7:03. 7:03 in that location at that time, there's no way you could have ever seen the moon, because it should not have been visible. Unless you guys have Superman eyes or something like that, there's no way you could have seen it. So what happens is their testimony can be rejected based on these astronomical calculations, even though it would have been accepted otherwise. That's one opinion. The second opinion is to use astronomical calculations to validate the beginning of the month of Ramadan without even anyone citing it. They say if it's visible in Argentina and there are Muslims there, but the Muslims, they all fell asleep for some reason, and they decided not to go out of their houses and even check for the moon. We know that it's visible in Argentina right now. So the fact that it's visible, we're going to go ahead and we're going to say that since it was visible for sure, the month of Ramadan is going to start the next day, even though no one physically saw it, but we know it was there. And in the right region, in the right location, we're going to go ahead and start it. All right, so that's something that you should keep in mind. And in fact, there's a lot of discussion about whether or not we should use the calculations to acknowledge the beginning of the next month or not. And that's the entire two-hour seminar tonight, 5:45 p.m., about whether or not we should use these calculations and how accurate they are and the history of these calculations and the science behind these calculations, okay? So I would really recommend you check that out coming back tonight at 5:45. And that's as long as the data is highly reliable, right? So that's, keep that in mind. How do you determine the end of the month of Ramadan? So now you're in Ramadan, you know when it started. You're fasting. To determine the end of the month, you start searching the sky, you go outside. Which day do you think of Ramadan do you go out to check? The 29th. So you go out on the 29th of Ramadan and you start going around and looking in the sky to see, is Ramadan going to be 29 days or is it going to be 30 days long? And if you see the crescent, it means, what does it mean? It means Ramadan is over. Ramadan was 29 days. The next month is starting tomorrow. So that's how you determine the end of the month of Ramadan. So if it's either seen or calculated, according to that opinion, the next day will be the first day of the month of Shawwal. So you have Sha'ban before Ramadan, and Shawwal is the month after Ramadan. So Shawwal, just to make sure you're awake and following along, is what number month in the Islamic calendar?
10.
Very good. Okay. So if it's not visible, and you can't see the moon, or you can't determine the calculation of the moon, the Ramadan is going to have 30 days, and the month of Shawwal will be the following day, will be the day after that. If there's, so if you're sighting the moon physically, if there's an obstruction in the sky, it's a cloudy day, how many witnesses do you need? So it was one for the previous one. But Muslim scholars said, for this one, you need two witnesses. So well, wait a minute, why one witness for entering the month of Ramadan, and why two witnesses for concluding the month of Ramadan? Because which one is to be on the safer side? If you make a mistake accidentally by accepting someone's testimony wrongly, and you started early, what did you do? You ended up fasting one extra day. If you stopped early, and the people were mistaken about their sighting, what did you end up doing? You cut off one day of Ramadan. So to be on the safe side, you make the standard stricter, because if you fast an extra day, it's better, and it's not a big deal if you fast an extra day. But if you cut off an extra day, then it's a problem. So it's something that needs to be kept in mind. Okay? So you need two reliable Muslim witnesses because there's a worldly benefit in skipping. So imagine you have a community where there's a bunch of people who are not honest. Of course, that would never be our community. But imagine there was a group of people who are not honest. What would happen? They would say, you know what? We don't care about Ramadan. Get three people together or a few people together and you come and say, come on, let's just say we saw the moon. And one of them qualifies for being a reliable witness for whatever reason. No one knows he's, you know, messed up or something like that. It's a big problem for the Muslim community. So the standards become stricter, two or even more. There's a worldly benefit. But if the sky is clear, the large number of people has to be seeing the moon. Otherwise, it's not going to count. It has to be very reliable. Now, if you see the moon yourself, okay, and your testimony is rejected, what should you do in this case? You not fast because it's certainty for you. In this case, to be on the safe side, you fast as well. Because in the previous case, you start fasting by yourself because to be on the safe side, in case you were right, you're going to go ahead and start fasting. But here, what if you were wrong? What if you were seeing things? It's better to fast an extra day. So in this case, it's opposite. You fast an extra day. It's more cautious to continue fasting. So that is determining the month of Ramadan. So requirements for fasting. So what are the requirements? Fasting is an act of worship. Right? So like as we mentioned before. So first you need to have the intention in order for this action to be accepted from you. So how could you not have the intention and how could you fast possibly? Well, imagine you woke up and you had the intention of dieting. Your doctor told you need to go on a diet. And you say, okay, I'm going to abstain from food. I have a blood test coming up. And you go, you abstain from food, you abstain from drink, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, well, will this count as my fast as well? No, it's not going to count as your fast unless you actually intended it, not only to have the intention for doing it for your blood test, but you had the intention to actually fast for Allah as well. So you have to have the correct intention, right? For the month of Ramadan, it's sufficient to make a general intention that you're going to be fasting this entire month. So you don't need to wake up every morning and say, okay, I'm fasting for Allah before I eat this food and I'm going to start my fasting. You make one general intention. This Ramadan, I'm fasting every single day. Even if you wake up late one day and the fast, you're already in the middle of fast, you already had the intention to be fasting this Ramadan, your intention will not break. Okay? If anything causes the intention to change, such as illness, you get sick, and you say, oh, well, I'm not fasting tomorrow because I'm really, really sick right tonight. Or you're traveling, and you say, I'm not going to be fasting. Then your intention to continue fasting Ramadan needs to be made again. So if you were ill, let's say tonight, and you say, I'm not going to fast tomorrow. Then the next day, you're ill again, and you don't fast the next day. And then the next day, you're debating, should I fast? I'm feeling better, I shouldn't fast. You need to have the intention before you begin. You can't start and say, oh no, I'm not going to fast. And then 2 hours after the fasting, you know, started, you know what, actually I'm feeling better, I'm just going to start fasting. You have to have the intention before you start the fast. That's very important. Okay? So keep the intention there and make the intention sincerely for Allah that you want to get closer to Allah by your fasting. What breaks your fast and what is required for you in fasting? So we talked about eating, drinking, and intercourse are the three things you absolutely need to refrain from. And this is in Islamic law. Remember, law is the external aspect of things. Internally, there's a lot more spiritually involved. You're not supposed to be using foul language, you're not supposed to be getting angry, you're not supposed to be getting, you know, upset at people and all of that. But we're just covering for this one the outward aspects in terms of what is legally required. If you get angry, it doesn't break your fast in the sense that you can start eating a burger again. But it breaks your fast in the sense that you don't get the reward for that fast because you just went and yelled at someone. And you're not supposed to be doing that. So spiritually, you've lost the reward of that fast. But technically, from a legal perspective, from an external perspective, your fast is still valid. So when we say valid, it means from an external aspect, not from a spiritual aspect, which is probably even more important. But still, the rules are important to know. So we're going to cover the rules mainly. So what breaks the fast? You have to make sure that from dawn until sunset, you don't do anything that breaks your fast among these three categories. So let's define what is dawn again, by the way. So we talked about dawn, the beginning of the prayer for Fajr time. Dawn is defined as when you're looking outside in the horizon, and imagine there were no houses, no mountains, nothing, and you could just see out there clearly, and you're looking at night. As soon as you see the white streak of light start coming out in the horizon, that's called dawn, the breaking of dawn. Okay? It's not sunrise. And many people confuse sunrise with dawn, and they're two different things. So keep that in mind. All right? Dawn, sunrise is when you're looking out in the horizon and the disk of the sun starts, this is what you can see, the disk of the sun starts to go and you see the top little tiny bit of the sun start coming up. That's sunrise. But dawn is when the sun is actually below the horizon, but some of the light starts creeping up and you can see this little white thread of light in the horizon. That's dawn. And that's when the fasting begins. So from that time until sunset, and sunset is when the sun is completely gone all the way below the horizon. From dawn until sunset, you refrain from three main things. Number one, eating or drinking. Absolutely no eating or drinking. That includes water. That includes everything. It includes any substance which is intentionally entering your body through your mouth, which resembles food or drink in some way, shape, or form. Okay? It also includes anything which enters your body from another place, but it results in nourishment to your body. So for example, if you have a glucose drip, you know, glucose going and being injected into your body and it's nourishing you, that's going to break your fast. Because then we'd have people selling to Muslims, hey, you don't eat or drink, but you can just get this glucose injected into you and you're going to feel great through the rest of the day. If you're in a hospital or something like that and you're getting it there, that's breaking your fast because it nourishes you. So if it nourishes you and it comes in through any part of the body, then in that case, it's considered to break your fast. If it nourishes or doesn't nourish you and it resembles food or drink in some way and it goes through your mouth and you swallow it down, then it breaks your fast. Anything outside of that does not break your fast, technically. Okay, so eating or drinking. Number two, intercourse will break your fast. You're not allowed to have intercourse. Any other type of foreplay which is done is allowed as long as no one gets to the point of being tempted to engage in intercourse. So if you should know yourself, and you should be careful about not going a little bit, you know, getting too intimate when you're fasting, because you might lose control of yourself, and you might end up going and doing something you weren't allowed to do in the first place. Now, this varies from person to person. So the Prophet used to say that he used to tell one young man came to him. And he said, "Am I allowed to, you know, engage in foreplay and this and that?" And he said, "No, you're not." And then there was another guy who came, and he asked him, and he said, "Am I allowed to do this and that?" He said, "Yeah, you are." So the companions were like, "Well, what's going on here?" He said, they realized that the young guy, the Prophet said no, because young people, newly married, you know, couples and all of that, they should not be doing this because they're not going to have that level of control. This other guy who came was really old, right? He'd been married for a long, long time. The level of self-control that they have when it comes to intimacy is very different, and they have experience. So they know what level they can go and what level they shouldn't be going to. So that's the way you determine that. Keep in mind, if you intentionally masturbate, it will break the fast. Okay, so intentional masturbation will break the fast. Unintentionally having a wet dream when you're sleeping or when you wake up during the daytime or something does not break your fast because it was unintentional. So it's not something that you're going to be held accountable for. But of course, you do have to perform your ghusl, your bath, before you start praying again. So that's category number two, intercourse. And number three, vomiting a mouthful intentionally. Okay, intentionally trying to vomit something up, which is at least like a mouthful of vomit, not like a little tiny bit where you kind of cough it up or something, but an entire mouthful or more. Unintentionally throwing something up does not affect the fast. Okay, so if you're sick, you get sick and then you vomit something up, it doesn't break your fast. But if you try to vomit intentionally, you try to induce yourself to vomiting, that will break your fast. Okay, so these are the things which do break your fast. Things which will not break your fast, right? If any one of these things, so by the way, if any one of the things which you're not allowed to do, if you do them forgetfully, and you totally forgot and you did them, your fast will not break, and you don't need to make up your fast, because that's something that you just weren't paying attention, you totally forgot. So in the middle of the day, you're thinking, "Oh man, I'm so thirsty," and you know, it's been a long day, and all of a sudden you just pick up that water and you start drinking. You get a burger, and you say, these are really good fries. These are my favorite fries. And you're eating, you ate like five fries, and then, oh my God, I'm fasting. You know, what do? You stop eating immediately. You don't have to induce yourself to vomit or anything like that, and you just continue fasting. Simple as that. Just keep on fasting as if it never happened. You just say, "Oh Allah, you know, forgive me, I forgot," and you move on. Your fast still counts. You don't need to make up your fast after Ramadan is over. You don't need to make a special prayer. You don't need to feel guilty for the rest of the day. Just be more alert next time, you know, and just try to remember that you're fasting. Otherwise, it's fine. Allah gave you that food. You know, maybe you needed it. You know, so He allowed you to get you that little amount of food, and then that's it. And you're done, and you continue fasting. You're fine. But you got to stop immediately. Now, you don't say, "Oh, well, let me just finish this fry, which is already in my mouth. I already chewed it. And I don't want to waste food. I'm a good Muslim, right? So let me just swallow that last one." No, you get rid of the food that's there. Now, the following things, which are very common, they do not break your fast. Okay, these are like the most common questions, and they don't break your fast. So the first three categories, I said they do break your fast. These are the things which you might think they do, but they actually don't. Number one, tasting food without swallowing the food. So if you taste food and you don't swallow it, then it doesn't actually break your fast. Now, obviously, this is disliked unless you have a good reason. So you don't go to the farmer's market and say, "Oh, samples? Can I just taste that? I'm fasting, by the way. I'm just tasting, okay?" You taste the sugar and you taste that. And this is for people who are like working in a profession as like being a chef. And you don't want to get fired. And when you're making that pasta and stuff like that, you got to taste the, you know, recipe that you just made. You don't swallow it. Just taste it with the tip of your tongue. If you see like enough salt, enough sugar, enough spice, or whatever it is, and then you spit it out. it's mainly for cooking, pretty much. So you do that if you have a good reason. So you're working as a chef or something like that, you can spit it out. You just taste it and you spit it out and you're good, the food is going to be prepared. Like the people who are preparing the food for in the mosque over here, for people who are breaking their fast. Right? You know what's going to happen if they don't taste it and there's the wrong amount of salt and everything? You got a lot of people who have gone the entire day without food and they're expecting the food, and imagine what's going to happen to that cook. Right? No, obviously, we're going to be very easy on the cook. But keep that in mind, okay? So you can taste it, but you don't swallow it. You spit it out immediately, and you don't try and like, it's really good. Let me taste a little bit more. Just taste what you need to. Number two, chewing food without swallowing it. So chewing, not meaning food per se, but chewing something without actually swallowing that thing. So if you chew something, like let's say, even chewing food, right? If you have a good reason for doing that, it's allowed. If there's no good reason, it's disliked, you shouldn't be doing it. So why in the world would you chew food without wanting to swallow it? If you have to chew it for your children, for example. Your children are not fasting, and they're little, and you need to chew something to, you know, just soften it up for them, and then you put it in their mouth. So you're allowed to chew that food for a reason, as long as you don't swallow any of it and you spit out there whatever remnants are there. So that's not going to break your fast, because technically you didn't swallow anything. So it doesn't break your fast. Number three, using eye drops does not break your fast. Very common question. You say, well, what if you use an eye drop or you use what's called kuhl, which is like an eyeliner type of thing, and when you put it in your eye, you actually feel this like sensation, this moisture sensation in your throat. It's a very, very common sensation that people have. They feel like a little moisture sensation in the throat. Something has gone through somehow to your throat cavity or whatever. It still doesn't break your fast. Okay? So using eye drops is fine. Using ear drops, it used to be thought that the ear canal is connected to the throat canal in some way, shape, or form, but it's actually not, and it doesn't break your fast. So using ear drops is also fine. Using a nose drop, even though the nose is connected to your throat, is also fine as long as you're not sniffing it in, it gets to your throat, and then you swallow it. So if you swallow it, then it's going to break your fast. If you don't swallow it and you just put the nasal spray in, or you just put the nose drops, but you're not getting anything in your throat and then swallowing it. If it gets to your throat and you spit it out, you're fine. So using nose drops is also fine. And using an enema is also fine. If you don't know what an enema is, you probably thank Allah. Enema is something that people need for medical reasons. Inserting from the rear end. Okay, so putting that's also fine. Those things are not nourishing and they're not directly connected to, you know, your stomach cavity. It's not going to be nourishing you or anything like that. So these things are fine. And the reason why is the medicine does not reach the stomach or nourish the individual. And that's the reasoning behind it. Number four, a medical injection. So any type of medical injection that you're getting, whether it's an intramuscular injection or it's an intravenous injection, it will not invalidate your fast because it neither reaches your stomach, in most cases, and it does not enter your body through the mouth. So it's not doing either of these two things. So it's not going to invalidate your fast. Number five. Medical patches. Medicinal patches. So having a medicinal patch, which you have on your you know, like, what are those heat patches or some of that? Neosporin, Salon Pass, those kind of patches and stuff like that. It's not going to break your fast either, because even though it's entering your body, it's not reaching your stomach, it's not nourishing your body, and it's not even entering through the mouth. So it's very, very safe. It's not going to break your fast at all. Number six, brushing your teeth with a wet brush, whether it's a miswak or a stick, or whether it's a toothbrush, or even whether it's with toothpaste, you're allowed to brush your teeth as long as nothing is swallowed. As long as you don't swallow anything, you're allowed to brush your teeth. But you have to be very careful when you're brushing near the back of your mouth, because it's more likely that you're going to swallow and if you gag or something like that. And when you're gargling, when you're putting rinsing water in your mouth, when you're done with brushing your teeth, don't go back and gargle if you normally do that. Don't go, because then it's actually going down. Now, it's true that when you brush your teeth, or even when you take water in your mouth when you're performing wudu, It's a fact that the water is being absorbed by your tongue, and it is nourishing you, but it's not going down your throat. And it's something that the Prophet, peace be upon him, and all the companions, they always made wudu, and they never stopped, you know, performing the rinsing their mouth part. So just keep that in mind. Don't gargle, but you rinse your mouth, is perfectly fine. Brushing your teeth is fine. Even using toothpaste is fine, as long as you're careful. Don't swallow anything and be careful. And if you swallow water normally when you're brushing your teeth, after, for whatever reason, be extra careful and make sure not to do that. Number 7, swallowing small bits of food that have been stuck in your teeth already when you were eating the morning breakfast. Right? And small, when we say small, small, like little tiny sesame seeds or something like that. Right? Because you just generally consider them to be kind of mixed in with your saliva, and it's, you're not intentionally eating those things. They're just kind of stuck in there. You can't just keep spitting out all the time. Some little tiny pieces will be stuck in your mouth. So whatever you swallow of that is not going to break your fast, because you're not even intending to eat any of those things. It's just left over. Try to brush your teeth after, you know, you eat your morning breakfast, and you should be fine. The next one is giving blood. So giving blood does not break your fast, but it's disliked to give blood if it's going to weaken you and it's going to make your fasting more difficult for you. So it's better not to give blood if you think you're going to get weak. But if you're tough, you've given blood before, you're like, it doesn't bother me, I don't even get lightheaded or anything, you can go ahead and give blood and it's not a problem. It will not break your fast. Next one is using an asthma inhaler. Now, this is a lot of debate among scholars about the asthma inhaler and whether or not it can be used. But generally, you know, it's something that I've thought a lot for, discussed with a lot of people. It generally goes into your lungs. Doesn't go into your stomach. Just goes straight into your lungs, and it doesn't actually provide any nourishment for your body. So since it's not falling in any of those categories, using an asthma inhaler would generally be okay. Okay, although some scholars differ with this, because they believe it's going through your mouth and it's getting into your body. The next one is inhaling incense or inhaling some other type of smoke, because it neither nourishes nor does it reach your stomach. So if there's incense being burned or something like that and you smell it, you say, oh well, the smoke, you know, the incense went into my, you know, body, I inhaled it or something like that, it's not going to break your fast either. Now keep one thing in mind, that it's when it comes to smoking, when it comes to smoking cigarettes, when it comes to smoking hookah, these are things that are prohibited for Muslims in the first place. We should not be doing them in Ramadan or outside of Ramadan, but Ramadan is the perfect time to quit these things. So once you know that you should not be using these things at all, especially not in Ramadan, especially not while fasting, this is the time where you can, the best time to quit if you're addicted to that. So this is a great opportunity to get rid of that. Otherwise, any type of other incense or something is not going to break your fast just by inhaling it. And lastly, rinsing the mouth with water or taking a bath to cool down. There's nothing wrong with that. So if you like, you know, I'm really hot and it's a long day and everything, just jump in the shower. Take a nice cool shower. You come out, you feel good, you're energized again. And then you're like, you know what? That worked for about 3 hours, but I'm hot again. Just jump in the shower again and cool down. There's nothing wrong with taking a bath or a shower to cool down. It's not like, oh, but it's not feeling the fast or something. No, you can go ahead and take it and there's nothing wrong with that. So it doesn't break your fast and there's nothing wrong with doing it either. Okay. Lastly, before I take questions on this subject, is there are some special rules about changing from one state to another state. And that is, if a person was not required to fast, let's say you're sick, let's say you're in a state of menstruation, but then during the day, it stops. You're fine now, or your menstruation ends, or something like that. Now you've changed to another state where you're supposed to be fasting, or vice versa. You were going to be fasting, and then all of a sudden, your menstruation started in the middle of the day, or you got sick in the middle of the day. What do you do when you're changing from one state to another state in the middle of the day? So like, let's say even a child becomes mature in the middle of the day. Someone who's not a Muslim, they accept Islam in the middle of the day. Do they start fasting immediately or do they not do that? What do they do in that case? So like a woman too, same thing. Woman begins her period and starts in the day, what should she do? So if someone is not a Muslim and they accept Islam during the day, they need to start fasting for the rest of the day. Okay, so they change from a state of not having to fast to having to fast. So in that case, they will start fasting even for that half day. When it comes to a woman who starts menstruating or starts having her lochia in the middle of the day, okay, when she didn't have it, now she's not supposed to fast. So she's going from a state of having to fast to not having to fast. She must break her fast. So she starts fasting and she's allowed to eat. So it doesn't mean that she, you know, she's allowed to eat. She doesn't finish that day. She starts eating, but she needs to make up that day later because she only did like half a day or something like that. Okay? If the excuse for not fasting goes away during the day, so for example, a woman's period ends, traveler returns back home, and he's not a traveler anymore, but he was deciding not to fast, a sick person was healed now, he's cured now, that person should refrain from eating for the rest of the day, but they still need to make up that missed day. So you say, well, wait a minute, okay, I'm a traveler, I started eating because it was hard for me, half the day has passed, and I come back home, and now I got to refrain from eating the rest of the half day, but I have to make up my fast anyways. So technically I fasted half a day, but I need to make up a whole day. So why? The reason why is because Muslim fasting is a community thing. So you don't want to be resembling anyone in the community where, you know what, you're going and eating. You say, well, I'm not in that case right now. I can go ahead and do this. If you have an excuse and the excuse is still valid, like let's say you're menstruating, right? You're allowed to eat and no one can say anything about you because you're allowed to eat 100%. But now here, it's better to even keep that half a day because technically you're in a state with everyone else. So you avoid resembling someone who's not fasting because technically you should be fasting. So that's the reasoning behind it. Okay? Whoever is excused from fasting, if you're ill, menstruation, whatever else it is, try to eat in private. Don't eat around other people because it might give them the illusion that you're violating Ramadan or something like that. So all of a sudden, you know, if someone doesn't know, someone's eating a burger and everything, and they're like, what are you doing, man? This guy's eating. They may not even ask you, right? You're like, man, I'm sick. You probably shouldn't be eating a burger when you're sick, by the way. It's health little rule there. But you're eating a burger or something, and all of a sudden people look at you, and they don't know that you're sick. They don't know that maybe, you know what, you have diabetes, you have to eat. So it's best to eat in secret so that people don't get the wrong idea, unless they know. And the thing is, you say, well, that's their problem. Why do they have to be so nosy and why do they look at me and everything? Okay, that's true. At the same time, people have natural, you know, tendencies, and there's whispers coming from shaitan. Start looking at that person, looking at that person. It's best to cut the problem at its root. So don't, you know, if you're excused from fasting, try to eat it in private. Try to eat in private when you can. What is recommended for fasting? So we talked about the requirements. So what is recommended? Well, first of all, it's recommended to wake up before dawn and to eat something as your pre-dawn meal, what's known as the suhoor, before you start your fast. So why? Why is this recommended? Because it's actually going to help you to remain strong, remain healthy throughout the day. A lot of people become lazy and they just say, oh, I'd rather just sleep an extra 30 minutes than eat that extra 30-minute meal. I guarantee you that eating that, even if you wake up for 5 minutes and eat something, drink something, is going to help you more than if you had that 5 or 10 minutes of extra rest. So it's very important. The point is not to make your life difficult. The point is not to get tired during the day. The point is to fast and stay in control of yourself, but you need to make sure that you have that meal. And in fact, it's actually better and more recommended to delay that meal until right before the fasting begins. So if you say, well, oh, you know what, I usually stay up till like 2 o'clock in the morning. So I'll just go ahead and have my meal at 2 o'clock in the morning. And then I'll just wake up for Fajr prayer at like 5 a.m. and I'll pray my Fajr and I'll skip the rest of the meal. It's actually better that you sleep at 2 a.m. You wake up again right before the fast starts. Let's say it starts at 4:50. You wake up at 4:40 and you eat for 10 minutes. It's better that you do that because it's closer. It's more, you know, blessing in that time anyways. And it's something that's recommended. The Prophet, peace be upon him, and all the companions, they used to do the exact same thing. And also on a side note, you should eat healthy food. for breakfast. I have to emphasize this because the Muslim culture has become, in many cultures, especially like Arab culture, Desi culture especially, they eat like fried ground beef or something like that for breakfast. Okay, this is not healthy. Eating like really oily fried foods in the morning is definitely not going to keep your energy sustained. You want to eat something that's what generally was called a little bit of complex carbohydrates. What they do is they give you energy, but the energy releases slowly over a long period of time throughout the day. You want to eat a little bit, maybe sugary foods, a little bit of sugar to get you some energy. You want to eat something that gives you a good balanced nutrition that you need for the day. And likewise when you're breaking the fast as well. So it's very important to eat good stuff as well. It's also recommended to begin fasting about 5 to 10 minutes before the actual time of dawn. Right? So don't just look at the time of dawn. It's better to maybe 5 minutes before you start. You stop eating 5 minutes before or something like that. And the reason why is that, one, so you don't accidentally keep on eating and drinking beyond the time. And two, because the calculation that's done for exactly the time of dawn, it's a little bit difference of opinion in terms of how it plays out. So it's better to be on the safe side and keep some little bit of a barrier. And that's recommended, so it's not a requirement. But if you do, it's better. When the sun sets, right, when your fast is over, it's recommended to break your fast immediately. So why immediately? Right? You might think, well, if I fast an extra hour, that's even better, I fasted more. So no, you actually break immediately to show that you're following the prescribed way of fasting that the Prophet, peace be upon him, taught us, and that way that Allah taught us. So it's not about you going and doing what you think is better. It's about following the way that the Islam actually taught you. So if you're in traffic, you're driving home, and you're stuck in traffic, and you know you're going to be stuck in traffic, you make sure to keep like some dates, or you keep something, food with you in the car, or some water so that you can break your fast while you're in the car. If you have nothing, you should actually pull over to a gas station, get some water, get a drink, and break your fast, and get back on the road again. So you should be breaking your fast exactly when the fast is over, to show that you're following the prescribed way. Okay, so that's important. It's also recommended to break your fast with an odd number of dates. And this is the practice of the Prophet, peace be upon him. So if you have, you know, dates, everyone knows what a date is pretty much. It's a type of little fruit, very, has a lot of sugar, has a lot of calories too, but it's very, very healthy and it gives you a lot of energy. It's very healthy, and there's been a lot of actually scientific studies that show that dates are a very good source of nutrients, and it's great, especially after you're done fasting. It helps you rehydrate your body, helps to rebuild some of the, things that, you know, you've lost while you were fasting. So you break it with an odd number of dates. Either one date is enough, or 3 dates, or 5 dates, or 7 dates, any odd number of dates. And if you have no dates, then you break it with water. So this is what the recommended thing is. First option is dates. If you don't have it, or if you don't want it, then water when you break your fast. And that's why you'll notice that in Ramadan, Muslims always have dates with them. And you'll find that everyone is going and buying a giant box of dates. Right, so this is the opportunity. If you want to get those dates, now's the time to go and get it. And they're really good, like deals all over Brookhurst Street and Anaheim and all these areas. Just buy a box of dates, enough for your family. If you're fasting by yourself, you just need 30 dates. If you got a wife or husband, 60 dates. If you got kids, just get an entire box. So you got your dates for the entire month. When you're breaking your fast, it's recommended to recite this following supplication, and that is, ذهب الظمأ وابتلت العروق وثبت الأجر إن شاء الله. And that means the thirst is gone, because you were thirsty the whole day. The thirst now is gone, because you're going to be breaking your fast and eating. The veins are moist, because you were like, you know, out of water basically. And the reward is affirmed if Allah wills. Meaning that I'm going to be rewarded for this fast if Allah wills, and I'm breaking my fast now. So this is the supplication to make when you're breaking your fast. You can say it in English, it's perfectly fine, however you say it. And if you're performing an optional fast, okay, not Ramadan, okay, Ramadan is mandatory fast. If you're performing an optional fast and you're invited to someone's house for a meal, okay, then and they're like, you know what, I put a lot of effort into really making this food and inviting you and everything, you say, but I'm fasting, I can't eat. I'm coming to your house, but you know, thank you so much for preparing all this food, but I'm not going to eat. You can pack it up in a box for me. I'm going to go home. That's kind of messed up, right? So actually, it's recommended to break your fast if the person is really going to feel offended and they put some effort into it. Even though it's, because it's an optional fast and you can break it. So you break that fast. It's recommended to break that fast. And it's not more pious to say, you know what? No, no, sorry, I'm fasting, you know. But Ramadan obviously is a different case. Right? Ramadan is a mandatory fast. You're not going to break that fast. So this is what's recommended during fasting. Let's talk about making up missed fasts. Okay. So whoever misses a fast and they need to make it up, they're allowed to make it up at their leisure. At their leisure means they don't need to make it up immediately after Ramadan. It can be done 1 month later. It can be done 3 months later. It can be done 7 months later. And some people who really want the easy way, guess which season they choose to fast in when they make up their fast? Winter, like right in the middle of winter, because it's the shortest period and it's nice and cool. That's the time to make up your fast if you're into that. But you have to make it up before the next Ramadan. So if you delay until the next Ramadan comes and you have not made up your fasts, then you will be sinful. So don't delay, and you should try to do it a little bit earlier than later. But you do have a, you know, a window to work with. And they don't even have to be made up in order. So if you miss 7 fasts due to whatever reason, illness or menstruation or something, you don't even have to make them up in exactly the order, even though in Ramadan it would have been in order. So you can make up 3, and then you hit up 2, and then you hit up 2 more, and you're fine. Even if they had a gap in between, that's fine. But don't miss. So I know people right now who are struggling to make up their missed fast, like right now, because Ramadan is starting next week. You should not be in that state where you're waiting till the end. It's not a good habit. All right? Whoever missed more than one fast, I just said it, can either you can make them up consecutively, or you can make them up intermittently. You can make them up with gaps in between. But obviously, if you did consecutively, it's better. Why? Because it resembles what you actually were doing in Ramadan. It's better and it's more closer to the way Ramadan was. Whoever has not made it up until the following Ramadan, like I said, if you don't make it up by the next Ramadan, you're sinful. But do you still have to make it up? Yes. It doesn't just drop. You say, oh, okay, I got the sin, but I'm not going to make it up. You still have to make it up, but you're late. It's like a late prayer. It's sinful for delaying a prayer without any good excuse, but you still have to make it up. It doesn't just drop and go away. So you're still going to be held accountable, so you got to do that. There's a penalty for violating the sanctity of the month of Ramadan. So we talked about this word kafara, which is a penalty for doing something which you weren't supposed to do. So there are some rules in Islam where there's a penalty, you have to do something. Like you have to fast this many days, you have to pay this much money because you didn't do something you were supposed to do. Like breaking a vow was one example. Whoever intentionally breaks their fasts in the month of Ramadan by eating or by drinking or by having intercourse in Ramadan, not only do they have to make up that fast, but they have to pay a certain penalty. As for doing what? For violating the month of Ramadan. The month of Ramadan is a special month. Everyone's supposed to be fasting. And you decide, you know what? You were in a really, really bad mood. You were in a rebellious mood that day. I don't care. I'm just tired of this fast. I'm going to eat something. And then all of a sudden you realize, you know, what did I do? Why did I do that? There is a penalty for that. So the penalty for doing that, I'm going to tell you in a moment. So why is there a penalty? It's to emphasize the idea that every single Muslim must take fasting very seriously in Ramadan. It's not something light, something that's very, very serious. So what is the penalty? Penalty is to, number one, free a slave. Now, you don't have, this was the penalty in the past. You have to free a slave. And it doesn't matter if it's a Muslim slave or a non-Muslim slave. If there's a slave to be freed, you have to free them. Now, freeing a slave was a very expensive thing in the past. It's not something cheap. So removing slavery from the community or from the society is something which is a great deed, but it's very expensive. So that was the penalty. Generally, we do have slavery today, but it's very, very hard to find a slave to free. So you're generally not going to find one. And then you say what kind of slave, there's these kind of slaves, and then there's the people who are being used for prostitution, they're considered to be slaves and all that. How do you free them when there's like a gang mafia running all of these operations? It's very hard to even do that. So if you're unable to do this, and pretty much there's no one in this community is going to be able to do that, you're going to have to fast for 2 consecutive months straight. That means 60 days. You fast consecutively straight. It's like 2 Ramadans. So you mess with Ramadan one time, and you have to make up 2 months of Ramadan outside of the month of Ramadan. All right? And when you're consecutively making up these things, anyone who has an excuse in the middle, so you say, well, okay, wait a minute. Let's say I have to make up 60 days of fasting. In the middle of fasting, I have my menstruation. So it's not consecutive anymore. Well, as soon as it's done, you have to resume again. If you have an illness in between, as soon as it's done, you have to resume again without even a one-day break. It'll still be considered consecutive as long as there's no other interruption besides that. Now, there are some people who will not be able to fast 60 days consecutively because they're weak, they're ill. They could handle a few fasts, but they can't handle this much. So if you're unable to fast 60 days, then you have to feed 60 poor people. 60 poor people for a day. That's with 2 full meals. When you feed someone for a day, it means 2 meals, right? Anyone who intentionally broke their fast more than once in Ramadan, so let's say you did it twice in one Ramadan, you still perform one penalty. So it's still 60 days. So if you broke your fast 3 times, you don't make it 180 days. It's still 60 days. Okay, but of course, hopefully you won't be doing that. If someone breaks their fast by doing something which resembles eating, drinking, or having intercourse, but it's not actually breaking it like that, then they have to make up the fast, but they don't have to pay a penalty. So let me give you an example. Somebody masturbates intentionally. They don't have to pay the penalty because it's not considered intercourse, but it resembles intercourse. So if you have intercourse intentionally, you have to make up 60 days of fasting. If you masturbate intentionally, you make up that day, but you don't have to make up 60 days. Engaging in foreplay and then you end up accidentally, ejaculating, but there's no intercourse involved. That's also, you make up that fast, but you don't have to do 60 days. If you vomit, mouthful, intentionally, that's outside of the category. You make up one day, you don't have to make up 60 days. And if you eat something which is not normally eaten by people, so for some weird reason you decide to eat some dirt or something like that, you make up that fast, but you don't have to fast 60 days. Okay. Other recommended fasts, and then now it's coming. So it's highly recommended to fast on the 10th of Muharram. So Muharram is another month in the Islamic lunar calendar. And the 10th day of Muharram is known as the day of Ashura. And Ashura is special and significant for one main reason primarily. And we fast on that day. Does anyone know what the reason is? That's right. Prophet Moses, Prophet Musa, was saved on that day when he crossed over the sea and the people of Pharaoh were drowned on that day. That's the reason why we fast. It has nothing to do with the death of anyone else that happened. It happened to be Hussein, who is the grandson of the Prophet, peace be upon him, also was martyred on that day. But that has nothing to do with this fast. Okay, this fast is because of Prophet Moses. So that's a very recommended day, highly, highly recommended to fast on the 10th of Muharram. And it's also encouraged to fast either a day before or a day after when you're fasting as well on that day. Because the Jews used to fast on this day. But to be a little bit different from them, we do an extra day before or an extra day afterwards. It's also highly recommended to fast 6 days of the month of Shawwal. Shawwal is the 10th month of the Islamic calendar. So that's after Ramadan or before Ramadan? After Ramadan. So immediately the month after Ramadan, there's 6 more fasts which you should keep. And it's highly, highly recommended if you fast those additional 6 fasts. You don't have to, but it's recommended. And why? Because they serve as the completion of Ramadan. So if you think about it, good deeds, if you learn there's a statement of the Prophet, peace be upon him, which says every good deed counts as 10 times the reward or more. So if every good deed counts as 10 times, when you fast Ramadan, you're fasting a month, right? That month of fasting is multiplied by 10, the sight of Allah, that's 10 months, as if you fasted 10 months. So you're only missing 2 months, and you would have it's like you fasted the whole year. Every year, you're fasting 10 months. You're getting the reward of fasting 10 months. If only you were able to fast the extra 2 months, you would. It's like every year you're fasting through the entire year. You get the reward as if you're fasting every day in the year. That would be awesome, right? So how do you do that? So the Prophet told us, if you do these extra 6 fasts, and the 6 fasts are multiplied by 10 good deeds, you got 60 days. Those are your 2 months. So he said, if you fast the 6 days of Shawwal, it's as if you fasted the entire year, because you fasted Ramadan times 10, 6 of Shawwal times 10 makes 60, 60 divided by, 30, 2 months, you get 12 months. That makes sense? Calculation-wise? So that's the way it is. So if you fast these 6 in Shawwal, it's like you're fasting the entire year after you finish your Ramadan, if you did your Ramadan, right? So this is great, and it's something that you should really, try to do. Now, do they have to be consecutive? No. They don't have to be consecutive. They don't have to be immediately after Ramadan. They could be anywhere in the month of Shawwal. Right, so just keep that in mind. Sometimes people think it has to be done immediately, like the day after Eid. No, that's not the case. All right. So that's the wisdom behind it. All right. So they don't have to be done in order. They could be performed on any day of the month of Shawwal, as long as it's done. It's also recommended to fast 3 days every month. So it's recommended to fast 3 days every month for any month, any time of the year. And it's preferable to do it on the 13th, the 14th, and the 15th of the month. Now, why do you think that is? What does the moon look like on the middle of the month, 13th, 14th, and 15th? Yeah, it's full, right? So it's the full moon that around that time. That is the easiest time to kind of remember when to fast and everything, middle of the month. So otherwise, you could do any 3 days, but these are 3 recommended days. These are known as the white days because the moon is at its largest size. They're called the white days. And it's recommended to do that. Why? Because it gives you some fasting every single month. You're doing some kind of fast, right? So just think about that. If you fast 3 days every month and each fast is multiplied by 10, and you do this literally every month throughout the year, it's like you're fasting the whole year, right? So those 3, it's like you're fasting the whole month in terms of reward, right? So that's one of the reasons why it's done. It's also recommended to fast on Mondays and fast on Thursdays, or both, because this is a practice that the Prophet, peace be upon him, used to do. So if you can do that, it's a good goal to have in your life. I'm going to start fasting on Mondays, for a period of time, or I'm going to start fasting on Thursdays, or both. You can almost fast on any day you feel like fasting, and it'll be considered an act of worship, and it's a great thing whenever you feel like fasting. But there are some days which it's disliked to fast on, and there's some days which it's prohibited, you're not allowed to fast on. So it's disliked to fast on a Friday or on a Saturday only. So if you just pick Friday and you say, I'm going to fast on Friday because Friday is the day of prayer and, we have the sermon and everything, you don't single out Friday only. Unless, let's say, it happens to be the 13th, 14th, or the 15th. And you wanted to fast those 3 days, then there's nothing wrong with fasting on Friday. But sometimes people will think in their mind, Friday is a special day. And it is. So I'm going to fast on Friday. Just because Friday is a special day doesn't mean that you're supposed to fast on the special day. So there's a certain way of doing things. And the Prophet wanted to make sure people don't confuse things and think that special means you start fasting. You do what Islam teaches you to do, not just what you think is going to be the best thing for you. So that's the reason behind it. Saturday also, because the Jews fasted on Saturday and they had their Sabbath and everything, so you don't do it only on that day unless there's a reason for it, right? Like it coincides with another day or something. That's when it's disliked. It's prohibited to fast on 5 days. The day of Eid al-Fitr, which is the day after Ramadan, is the day of celebration. The day after Ramadan is completely prohibited. No one is allowed to fast. The day of Eid al-Adha, the second day of the festival, after the Hajj pilgrimage, that's also prohibited to fast on that day. And on the 11th, the 12th, and the 13th of Dhul-Hijjah, so the days following the Eid al-Adha, the second Eid, it's prohibited to fast on those days. So basically the 2 Eids, and then the 3 days following the second Eid, it's prohibited to fast on these 5 days, all right? And the reason is because Muslims are celebrating on these days. And when you're celebrating, part of the celebration is everyone eats together. And if you say, no, 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 I decided I want to fast on this day, you're cutting yourself off from the community and you shouldn't be doing that. So it's prohibited. Otherwise, you can fast almost any other day. It's also prohibited to fast every single day with the intention that you're going to continue throughout the rest of your life. So you know what, I'm going to fast every day for the rest of my life. It's not allowed in Islam. You say, well, why is it not allowed in Islam? Because Islam is about moderation, it's about balance, and it keeps people in check by making sure they don't become extreme. Even when it comes to something good, being that extreme is going to weaken your body and you won't be able to keep it up without difficulty and messing up your life. So it's not allowed to fast every single day. So if you decide, you know what, this year, I'm going to fast every single day this entire year. You're not allowed to do that as a Muslim. You should not be doing that. You'll lose the purpose of fasting. You become accustomed to it. Your body becomes weak and it's not good. It's also prohibited to fast 2 days in a row straight, not breaking your fast. So if you're in Ramadan, you say, you know what, sun just set. You know, I feel great. I don't even need to eat. I can do another day straight. And you don't eat at all the whole night, and then you start to fast again the next day. You cannot do that. You have to break your fast. It's not allowed in Islam. You say, well, wait a minute. Well, I'm getting closer to God that way, and it's better for me. No, because there are restrictions to make sure you don't become extreme even in that. So that's not allowed. Last thing we're going to cover is what's known as i'tikaf, and that's seclusion in the mosque. So i'tikaf is something which is highly recommended, that someone goes and they seclude themselves inside of a mosque for a period of time. The most recommended one is the last 10 nights of Ramadan. So Ramadan has, let's say, 29 or 30 days. The last 10 nights, or as many as possible, it's really, really recommended that you go and you stay inside the masjid. This is called i'tikaf, which means seclusion. And you can do it any time of the year, but in Ramadan it's really, really recommended, the last 10 nights of Ramadan. What is a mosque? Let's talk about what is a mosque. Because many mosques around here, they're rental buildings in a commercial area. So is that considered to be a mosque, or it's not considered to be a mosque? So a mosque actually is defined by the intention of the people who started that mosque. And one of the conditions is that as long as people are generally praying in that place 5 times a day, even if it's one person or something like that, usually they're praying 5 times a day, it's considered to be a mosque. If it's not, and they're not praying 5 times a day, they only open for Friday, or they only have 2 days, they're open and then they're closed the rest of the week, it's not considered to be a mosque anymore. It's called a musalla, just a place where people pray, but it's not a mosque. So you go and you isolate yourself inside of a mosque in the last 10 nights of Ramadan. This is known as i'tikaf, and it's a great act of worship. So what are the requirements? What do you have to do? What do you mean isolate yourself in a mosque? What do you do exactly? The requirements are very simple. You do two things, all right, in order to be in a state of i'tikaf or seclusion. Number one, you stay inside the mosque and you don't leave without some kind of necessity, all right? You just stay there. You can be reading Quran, you can be doing whatever you want, you can be even just having a conversation, you know, try to focus on something that's beneficial. But the fact that you're inside the mosque and you decided, I'm going to stay here, I'm not going to the mall, I'm not going home, I'm not going shopping, I'm not going anywhere else, I'm going to stay in the mosque for these 10 days or whatever period you can do, it's a great act of worship. I said leaving without necessity. So what is a necessity? A necessity would be that you need to go out in order to get some food. Now, if you have family or if you have friends who can bring you food, they need to bring you the food. You're not supposed to be leaving. But if you're, let's say, you don't have friends, you don't have family, you don't have anyone who can help get you some food, you're allowed to go out, grab some food, and come right back because you need to break your fast. You need to eat something. Helping someone in an emergency situation. So if you have the option of staying inside the masjid and someone really, you know, middle of the night, flat tire, they call you up, look, man, I'm in the middle of the freeway, I really need some help, can you help me out? Say, you know, I'm sorry, I'm secluding myself in the mosque. No, you leave the mosque and you go and you help that person, all right? Using the toilet, let's say the toilet is obviously, let's say it's outside of the mosque area, right? Or let's say there's a mosque, but there's no toilet in a mosque, let's say hypothetically. Really, really bad masjid administration, but you would have to walk across the street to use the toilet. Obviously, you're allowed to leave the mosque for that, and then you come right back when you're done. You don't stop by, you know, the quickie mart or whatever and get some food and then come back, unless you needed to. It's only allowed to leave for the amount of time that would be necessary to perform that required task, the thing that you need to get done. Women who feel safer and more comfortable to perform the i'tikaf in their house may actually do so in their house, provided that they're inside that part of their house which is designated for prayer. So most places they have this place in their house where this is like the prayer area. So you're going to be staying in that prayer room or that prayer area, especially if you live in an area where it's not very safe for women or even for children or young people or someone to be around. They can go ahead and do that in that part of their house. So that's condition number one, is just you got to stay inside the mosque. That's it. Condition number two, no intimacy or intercourse is allowed in i'tikaf during the daytime or the nighttime. All right, no intimacy, no spousal relations or anything like that, because it's a continuous act of worship and you're just focusing on that. If you violate any of these two requirements, your i'tikaf is broken and you just need to start again. But if you want to do all 10 days, you don't break any one of these things. And that's it. There's nothing else. You're allowed to speak, you're allowed to talk, you're allowed to use the cell phone, you're allowed to use the phone, you're allowed to go on the internet, you're allowed to do all these other things. Now, it's not recommended necessarily to waste your time, because you're sitting in the mosque for a reason. You're not there to just have conversations with people. You're not there to, you know, run your business on eBay from the mosque, although anyone can do that. The goal is to focus on reading Quran, reading some books, praying, making zikr, remembering Allah, just focusing, and just being inside the mosque at that time is going to have a change in your environment. You know, when you go to the mall, you have a different mentality. When you go to like some kind of recreation area or a park or something, you have a different mentality. You go to the forest, you have a different mentality. Just being inside the mosque for that long period of time, it just shifts your mentality. So I recommend you try it sometime. If you haven't done it, try it. Anyone done it? Anyone done 10 days before? Anyone, you done 10 days? Anyone done like a few days? It changes you. It really, really changes you. You could do it in any mosque around this area. Just make sure you ask the administration that it's allowed for you to do it or not, right? In some places they have showers as well. Some places they don't have showers. So you need to go to a one that has maybe some facilities or something like that. What are the etiquettes that you should be doing when you're at i'tikaf? So like I said, when you're inside, you should focus on your prayer, on worship, and on reflection. And it's disliked to focus on anything which is considered like a worldly activity, like doing business, unless you need to buy food or something that's different. Speaking about things which will distract you away from remembering Allah is disliked. But keep in mind, it's also disliked to be quiet and not talk to anyone at all. So there's this mentality and this idea that you just sit there and you don't speak at all. That's not true. So if someone comes, says, "Salam, how are you doing? How's your family?" You're like, get the gaff. That's not correct either, okay? Because that used to be the case in the past. In the previous scriptures, the seclusion in the mosque used to involve not speaking as well. And you find that in some of the stories, like Zechariah, when he was not speaking for a period of time, that was part of his i'tikaf and his seclusion in the mosque. But that's not for us anymore. So we're not supposed to resemble, because what happens is there are people who go into like meditation for days on end. The Buddhists have it, Hindus have it, some Christian monks and stuff, they have it. And when it comes to Islam, Islam is supposed to be not resembling other people. There's good practices where, you know, we do the same thing among the good things that they do, but Islam is supposed to actually stand out and be a little bit unique. So there has to be some differentiating factors. And this is one of the very important differentiating factors that we are allowed to talk when you're in i'tikaf. Doesn't mean you become a chatterbox or something, but at the same time you're allowed to talk when you're in i'tikaf. So that's a common misconception. And lastly, the day after Ramadan is the day of Eid, and it's known as Eid al-Fitr, which means the festival. Eid means festival, Fitr means breaking, fast breaking. So it's the festival of breaking your fast. And this is basically a celebration for Muslims. All Muslims in the world are going to be celebrating right after the month, day of Ramadan, the month of Ramadan is over. And we go to people's houses and we eat and we drink, we exchange gifts. In some cultures, you know, people give, you know, gifts to children and give them money and cash and all of that. So this is a day where you're supposed to basically be partying. You're not supposed to be, you know, sitting at home. You're not supposed to be by yourself. You're supposed to be enjoying yourself, going and meeting other people, going to people's houses. There's an Eid prayer in the morning, and then the rest of the day, you know, you're supposed to have fun. You're supposed to meet people. You're supposed to enjoy. You still pray, and there's still four more prayers at the end of the day, throughout the day, but you're supposed to be enjoying yourself. So it's very important, try to prepare for Eid. And my advice when it comes to Eid, if you have children in particular, children look around living in as Muslim minorities, they look around and they see, you know, Christmas is full of lights, and they see, like, you know, Halloween is full of devils, or no, they're full of like decorations and stuff like that. There's always like something going on, right? And when it comes to Eid, if you make the family like a boring Eid, your children are not going to really enjoy Eid. It's like, oh wow, look, it's Eid. We're going to drive to the place, we're going to pray, and then we're going to go home and you're going to watch me talk to Uncle so-and-so while you sit in the corner and be bored out of your mind with some kids who you've never met in your life before, and you're probably not going to meet until next Eid again. You're not setting a good example for your kids, right? You want to make this really fun and special. This is a great time to pick up on those unsold Christmas lights, you know, that in December, get them for cheap. Decorate the place. Even for Ramadan, there are places. Decorate your house. Put some lights in there. Put some decorations. Get them some really awesome gifts, like way better, like birthdays, like whatever you would plan on getting your children for a birthday, just outdo it on the day of Eid. So like, you know what? Well, you know, my friend, they got a bicycle, you know, on Eid. So, you know, I got you a racing car on Eid, right? So that just blows his bicycle away. Like, you want to really do something special so that people, the children, and you yourself, you feel great on the day of Eid. You're supposed to wear nice clothes, buy some brand new clothes, have it all ready. Get some gifts ready, give it to your nieces and nephews and family and all of that. Go out for breakfast, you know, as a family and everything. This is a great time. Prepare Eid celebrations. But here's what you don't want to do. You don't want to be thinking about how you're going to party on Eid in the last 10 nights of Ramadan, because that's the most important nights of Ramadan. So if you, let's say you do seclusion in the mosque and you're secluding yourself and you're thinking, oh man, I need to buy those gifts. How am I going to buy those gifts and those lights and the clothes? What kind of clothes am I going to buy? I need to go to the mall. I need to go shopping. I need to do this. Handle that beforehand. So now this is the week before Ramadan. Handle all that stuff now. Get the gifts. Get the clothes. Think about what you want to wear. Think about what kind of shoes are going to match your dress and this and all that stuff. And handle it now so you have a really, really nice Eid and a great Eid, inshallah. All right. So that's about it. That's all I have.